Welcome to the Center for Lit Podcast Network. You're listening to How to Eat an Elephant, a little book club for large books. Have you ever cast your eyes across a shelf full of classics and been driven screaming from the room by 500-page monsters with thick spines and important names? Then this is the show for you. We're here to take on these scary books together, because how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Hello, and welcome back to How to Eat an Elephant. I am not Ian, your host, obviously, but I am still here with Megan. Megan, how's it going?
It is going so well. Today, the cat is away and the Mises are playing.
It's Ladies' Day here at How to Eat an Elephant. Ian is taken off for a business trip and he has left us alone. I think it's a very funny chapter set for us to be left alone with.
I was thinking that too. It's got a lot of very important battle strategic chapters, but also our favorite Pierre is back for the first time in a long while. And hooray. Ian's gonna be so mad that he's missing it.
Well, and it's just so much strategy and geographical information that he's left us to figure out on our own. In fact, there's a whole chapter where Tolstoy is basically like, all of the historians of Borodino were wrong, and here's why, and here's a real map, and thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
It did feel like a TED Talk. It was like everything he's been saying about historical theory, he was just exploding it. And he was like, and now I'm a historian, and here's the truth about the past. Complete with a map. Can I even express to you how bad I am at reading maps? It is not one of my skills. I'm directionally challenged in my own neighborhood. You put it in a map, it's even worse. This is hopeless. I hope you're better at this than me.
I am not. Well, you've driven in the car with me. We're left together, we would be absolutely hopeless.
Yep. We've lost our commander. We are at sea.
But we will forge ahead.
Yep.
Well, we pick off where we left off last time with Kutuzov, and we get the end of the episode with the priest's wife.
Oh, yes.
That we started talking about.
Okay, I feel badly. Now that I've read the chapter, Ian was trying to save me from doom. At the end of the last chapter, I was like, what I remember about Kutuzov and women is that when the war was not going on and the Russians were all at peace for a moment, he was just womanizing. And I do not see that in this chapter. Ian was so right. That is not what's happening here. He's actually just being a steady, almost kind of passionless father figure in this scene. And I was glad to see it and chastened in my former reading.
I would like to stand up for you for a second.
Really?
Because we see him, he takes the offering from the priest's wife and thanks her. And he goes to his office and he starts reading this book by Madame de Genlis. And this book is basically like a bodice ripper of
the
time.
Is it really?
He's just reading a trashy romance is what Andre catches him reading.
Oh my gosh.
So, I don't know if passionless is quite right.
Oh, I'm so glad about that. I was like, wow, how could I have been so far off? I know I didn't remember the last detail wrongly, but maybe we're supposed to be getting a more well-rounded picture of him. I'm so glad I wasn't so far off.
I think that's interesting because Andre kind of ends up saying that the reason Kutuzov is such a great general is that towards the end of that chapter, it says, the more he saw the absence of anything personal in this old man, in whom there seemed to remain only the habit of passions, and instead of intelligence, which groups events and draws conclusions, only the ability to calmly contemplate the course of events, the more calmed he felt over everything being as it had been. And so it's kind of both of what you were saying. He's both calm and collected, but the reason is that he's not personally involved in his passions. It's just a habit of passions.
Kind of a leftover habit from his youth. Is that what he means? He's no longer so invested?
Yeah, maybe age has made it so that he knows that he doesn't stand a chance with the women. And so he gathers his passions from books, but he's not. It kind of is embodied in the reading of a book. Mm-hmm. He is partaking of the passion, but he's not personally involved in it.
He's distanced from it. Interesting. Well, I kind of like that, particularly as it connects to the conversation that Kutuzov has with Andrei. He wants to have him in and talk about the death of Andrei's father and extend fatherly compassion to him. And at the same time, it leads to a conversation about Kutuzov's battle strategy with the two virtues that he sees being the most important to win a war, being patience and time. Both of those are also qualities that you gain with old age, right? You're only capable of patience when you've had to wait a lifetime. The young are not patient, but you see patience in the old, and Kutuzov is demonstrating that in his person, even as he espouses it as a military philosophy, which I think is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, the fact that he's not young and eager to jump into the events means that he can live out Tolstoy's philosophy of history, which is to let things be as they are.
Yes, I have it written at the top of my page. Kutuzov is the poster boy for Tolstoy's true great man. Tolstoy's like, if there is a great man, it's Kutuzov, because all he does is sit and say, it had to be so.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, what is the real take on that phrase, it had to be so, that Pierre repeats to himself? Because when Pierre does it, it seems yucky. It seems like he's giving up. But here, it seems that Tolstoy is praising it. He says, to finish what I was reading earlier, Prince Andrei thinks he won't have anything of his own. He won't invent, won't undertake anything, but he'll listen to everything, remember everything, put everything in its place, won't hinder anything useful or allow anything harmful. He understands that there is something stronger and more significant than his will, the inevitable course of events. And he's able to see them, able to understand their significance, and in view of that significance is able to renounce participating in those events, renounce his personal will, and direct it elsewhere.
So interesting how he acknowledges, well, Tolstoy acknowledges here that there's something stronger, more significant than the human will, but he's quick to qualify that as the inevitable course of events. It's not necessarily don't jump to a God figure. That might not be what he's talking about in a stronger will than a human being's. He's just talking about that swarm life mentality, many events, many causes making an event happen rather than one man's will.
Yep. I don't know what to make of it. I mean, we had that one passage a couple chapters ago where he called it Providence with a capital P, but
I just think it's funny. Every time I'm expecting him to go one direction, he goes another. You know, he's got those two philosophies and he's interwoven them so much so that there's not a clear, it's as nebulous as his philosophy. It's like he's saying, don't try to pin me down. I'm not always talking about God here.
Well, it does seem that here he is probably talking more about how a human being should participate in those events, particularly when so much is on the line. Lives are on the line, the future of the nation is on the line. And so how does one interact with such a world in which there are so many causes that things are more or less inevitable? And Kutuzov's answer is patience and time. And the reason it says that Kutuzov in particular causes everyone to calm down is that he's so Russian.
Yeah. Also, there's a contrast in every time there's a scene with Kutuzov and Andrei, there's a contrast between youth's response and old age. And we have Kutuzov mocking Andrei again. Andrei says, I don't want to be one of your advisors. Thanks for the honor, but no thanks. I am actually finding a lot of fulfillment in being loved by the regiment, and I want to stick with them. What did you make of Kutuzov's mocking smile in response?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Is it that he still sees through Andrei? And I mean, he affirms his decision to go into the regiment and says, I remember what you did for us at Austerlitz, which just lights Andrei's fire. He's so excited that he remembers that. But it does seem that maybe there is something that he sees in Andrei that says this is still an act on your part. You're still trying to get to the heart of what's actually important.
Well, and he acknowledges, okay, advisors are always plentiful, but men are not. And that seems, it seems kind of like he's being ironic or sarcastic in that comment, right? Ah, yes, advisors are plentiful. There are many men trying to give me opinions who are qualified to direct forces. But men, boots on the ground, are not plentiful. That's just not true, mathematically speaking. Unless he's talking about the quality. A true man is not easy to be found. What did you think of that?
Well, even if he is genuinely saying so many people want to give me their advice and aren't willing to just do the hard work, which is true of human nature. We would all rather be in command than not. But it does seem like there's something dark to it. Like, well, there's so many advisors and never enough bodies for the cannons.
Actually do it. Yeah.
So if you want to go be mincemeat, go right ahead and do that.
Well, which does connect to Andre's own thought as he watches all the men bathe, right? And he says they're cannon fodder. All of this flesh in the water is just food for the cannons later. Maybe Kutuzov is musing similarly. But I did like that. Even in amongst all of the mocking tone there and all of the guesses we could make about Kutuzov's real intention, he does remember the quality that Andre has and how blessed Andre would be in being remembered for his glory. And he throws him a bone and acknowledges him and affirms him and builds him up like a father. And Andre goes away glowing, right? I think I'm not sure what to make of Kutuzov.
Well, yeah, what do we do with the fact that he is the kind of man who wept easily, and his special gentleness and pity for Andre now was caused by a desire to show sympathy for his loss? But he's a man who weeps easily. He reads bodice rippers, French bodice rippers, and he weeps easily.
Well, both of those seem like you were saying, qualities of a true Russian, right? That his feelings are very close to the surface, and he's not ashamed of his emotion.
He leads with emotion as opposed to cold reason.
Right.
Maybe. And that's what allows him to be in touch with what's actually called for in the moment.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of leads us to the next chapter in which all of Moscow is in danger and there's kind of a swarm life mentality going on here. And they're split into two opinions. There's the With the enemy's approach to Moscow, the Muscovites' view of their situation not only did not become more serious, but on the contrary, became still more like-minded, as always happens with people who see great danger approaching. At the approach of danger, two voices always speak with equal force in a man's soul. One quite reasonably tells the man to consider the properties of the danger and the means of saving himself from it. The other says, still more reasonably, that it is too painful and tormenting to think about the danger when it is not in man's power to foresee everything and save himself from the general course of things, and therefore it is better to turn away from the painful things until they come and think about what is pleasant.
So in other words, when you're on your own, when a man is in solitude, he thinks of self-preservation. But when you are in company, it's easier to distract one another until you can't anymore. Ignore the impending doom and just distract one another with frivolities. And so that's what the Muscovites are doing.
I think that's really interesting. And I feel like I've experienced this before.
Yes.
Like
hashtag college paper season.
I was literally thinking like final exams. Final exam is a fixed date. And if you're by yourself, you get super up in your head and you just study and study and study and study. But if you're with other people, everyone just has to eat, drink, and be married for tomorrow we die.
It's so true. Yep. Reading day on a Hillsdale College campus looks like a bacchanal for this reason.
But do you think that Tolstoy is saying that that is a bad thing, that the people are distracting themselves with frivolities in the face of this danger? Or does that go back to what Kutuzov is saying, that all situations call for patience and time? And so you might as well do what's directly in front of you and what's pleasant until it's clear what you should do.
Well, I agree with you. Well, I think that second thing. That it's good for them to just distract themselves because what else can they do? Except for the fact that they can do something. They can leave. They can leave Moscow. And it seems really foolish to me that they are just sitting there waiting for it to come. They're totally capable of moving off to a safer location. They have wealth. They have resources. These are the elite of Moscow. And they're sitting here twiddling their thumbs and laughing about it instead. Until a very important moment. And it feels like they're mocking those families without resources like the Rostovs who are stuck in Moscow until they sell their home. They're hoping to sell their Moscow house And they're like the gossip of the salon, right? Because they might not be able to do that. And how silly it would be to buy a house in Moscow at this moment. So they're probably not going to make the sale and they'll be stuck here. Sucks to be them, right? And yet all these conversations are happening in Moscow. There are rich people still there having this conversation. And it seems kind of, I don't know, hypocritical to mock the Rostovs in this position.
But what about Pierre, who defends the Rostovs? Do you blame him for still being in Moscow?
Well, I blame him for larger things than that, I think. He's still in Moscow because he can't make a decision about anything. It's the larger existential indecision that I think I blame him for. He keeps talking a big game about, you know, going to find Napoleon himself and building up a giant regiment to send into the battle and contributing. And yet we don't see a lot of effect from all of his talk. He's still at parties, stuffing himself, you know?
Interesting.
What did you think?
I think that I agree with you. There's that moment where he's playing a game of patience and he says, if this comes out, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm leaving this decision to fate. And if it comes out, I will do what fate tells me to do. And he still doesn't. And then he doesn't.
Yeah.
So he's still not willing to, I don't know. He's not even resolved enough to allow the fates to decide his actions. He is actually choosing for himself.
He is.
In that moment.
But not outspokenly. Not in a way that he's taking responsibility for it. Also fascinating that the game he's playing, the game of chance, is called patience. I think that's so interesting, given that that's one of the things that Kutuzov says is a motivator of a good battle strategy. So are we supposed to approve of what Pierre is doing? I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm torn about it because I can see that he does eventually go to join the army and... And we'll talk later about the things that he sees on the way, but I do think that they kind of, if he's at fault for anything based on the images in this reading, I think what he's at fault for is worrying about whether or not he should go instead of just enjoying the dailiness of
letting
his
fate
existence.
Move him. Yeah.
Yeah. And if he is going to stay in Moscow, then he should do so and be present there instead of constantly dithering back and forth about whether it's the right thing to do.
Oh yeah, that resonates. I do love that what Pierre is experiencing is still one and the same with the first Pierre in the drawing room. He walks back into now it's Julie, it's not Kerrigan Drubetskoy. Anymore. Drubetskoy's drawing room. And he's just as awkward and out of place. And in fact, when he comes in, they were mocking how he would look with his big fat body in a uniform at the front of a regiment. He comes in and is just as awkward as ever. And I thought,
the great thing
Pierre.
About him is that he comes in and says, no, I would look so weird and awkward in front of a regiment. And it just disarms everyone because he gossips on himself, basically.
I'd be much too easy a target for the French. And I'm afraid I wouldn't be able to get up on a horse. I have in the margin, self-deprecation kills mockery.
He's
so good.
So lovable.
Well, and also from that position of strength where he's got nothing to prove to these people and he makes fun of his own self, what he can't bear is them making fun of Natasha, which is where the conversation turns next. Julie makes fun of how Natasha is recovering from the scandal. And she even makes fun of Pierre as Natasha's chosen knight to protect her honor. I thought that was interesting. That does make him bristle in a way that arrows to his own pride really don't land.
Yeah, well, they're playing games with serious issues. With that, they're fussing with Pierre. I think they know. I think Julie knows that Pierre is personally involved in that situation and cares and is playing. And she's toying with that in him. And then also there's the game they play with the Russian and the French.
Oh my gosh, that was so interesting.
What do you make of that? The fact that they've turned the speaking of French into a game for raising money. And Julie Is it like just a power move to show her wealth that she's like, eh, and just like launches into French whenever she wants?
I don't know. Maybe I hadn't thought of that element, that maybe she's just showing off her wealth. I really did think it harkened back to how silly we thought Julie was when she was single. The way that she was trying to catch a man was with this, you know, game of melancholy. It seems to me that this was another evidence that she's kind of an empty-headed woman. She's not very educated. She admits here in this scene that she hasn't been educated in the ways of Russian. And so she doesn't really know how to speak it. And she's just going to lose this game. And they're taking pot shots at her. So I guess I thought she was stupid. But maybe your reading is better.
No, I like that you drew it, the connection to the melancholy, because that's the same thing. It's playing a game with... It's a game of sorrow instead of actual sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they're treating the Rostovs.
Yeah. It made Julie really easy prey for Boris. And I tend to think lowly of her as a result.
Yeah.
This seems silly in the same kind of way.
Me too. Well, what do we do with the fact that Pierre... is staying in Moscow. He stays past everyone else, even past Julie. And the reason that he does so is that it has become pleasant for him, the more obvious that a catastrophe is approaching.
Yes. Well, that seemed to me to be another instance where Pierre is hoping that the apocalypse will come so that he can be of some use. He's expecting drama and intrigue and the end of the world, and everything that compounds in his own life to point that direction, he's grateful for, because his reading is right. Ah, yes, I knew the end was coming. I saw it in all that numerology. That's what it made me think of.
I did not think about the fact that he is hoping for the apocalypse in that way. That is interesting.
What did you think of?
Well, what I see is that his life is a mess. He is in an unhappy marriage and he has no idea what to do with himself or his wealth. And so I think what he's hoping for from a catastrophe is that it will destroy his life.
Ah, because he's unhappy.
Yeah, that weird thing that happens when there's a catastrophe where the everyday concerns of life become not important anymore and there's an all-fixating concern instead. There's some way in which a catastrophe can be an escape. And I wonder if he's hoping for that. And maybe that's what he's hoping for out of the apocalypse as well. And I think you're right that ultimately it would be his usefulness that would shine through in that moment.
But also, I like your reading too, because it would be the end of this awkward waiting game where he tries not to go to the Rostovs. He's here and everyone else is leaving, and the Rostovs are here, and they're just down the street, and he doesn't go, because it represents everything he can't have. He's married, and unhappily so. There's Natasha available, and he's in love with her, but he can't have her.
He does end up leaving his house. What is it that makes him leave in the end?
Isn't it that he finally decided to go? The whipping of that French baker? I think he's a baker. But I was led to believe... Maybe I read this wrong, but it seems to me that the French guy already lived in Russia. He's kind of like Mademoiselle Bourienne, just sticking around with the Russian people that he was living with as the French storm in. And so his neighbors have turned on him and called him a French spy. And they're beating him. And he's weeping. I thought that was a really interesting social moment to get a window into. And funny that Pierre would step out his door and see that and then be moved.
Moved to join the army, which is in some ways a patriotic movement, but he's witnessing a gross act of misplaced patriotism in that moment. And I think he knows it too, because that's what makes him feel bad, the abuse of power in that moment.
Yeah, and he says he could no longer remain in Moscow. This is something I can't keep watching. And so on to I have an idea of a way that I could be purposeful and useful. No more lingering here. I don't like to watch what's going on. That's how I read it anyway.
Yeah, I can see that.
And he makes the decision so definitively, but so much in his own mind that he gets angry with his coachman. He's decided, as he's already on the way somewhere else, to go back home and pack up and leave Moscow. And he's furious that his coachman didn't read his mind.
Do you take that as a sign of his, that we should read what he's doing with a grain of salt? That like this isn't maybe a purely motivated action on his part? That if he's getting frustrated with his servant, then he's not actually doing this for any good purpose, that it's about him still?
It did seem to be just as, I don't know, just as changeable and flighty as Pierre always has been. This doesn't seem like a definitive decision on his part. It seems sporadic. And even the next line after he's told the coachman to take him home, it says he'd decided so definitively that he could no longer remain in Moscow and would go to the army the same day that it seemed to him he had either told the coachman about it or the coachman should have known it himself. On returning home, Pierre told his all-knowing, all-capable coachman, familiar to the whole of Moscow, that he would go to the army. I'm skipping all these words I don't know how to pronounce. And ordered his riding horses sent there. So in other words, he basically decides so quickly and all in his own head. And Tolstoy treats that with a sarcastic tone, as if your coachman could be all-knowing. You haven't made your intentions clear to anyone, even yourself. You're deciding this on a whim.
I think that's really insightful, that the reason that he can't be clear with anyone is that he refuses to be clear with himself.
What do you make of the end of this chapter? Given that he's deciding all of these things, he's telling himself that it's all very definitive, but it's actually quite vague and flighty. He feels a sense of pleasantness at the end once he's made this decision. And the passage is kind of, it's strange. I'm going to read it and I want to know what you think. He now experienced a pleasant sense of awareness that everything that constitutes people's happiness, the comforts of life, wealth, even life itself, is nonsense, which it is pleasant to throw away in comparison with something. With what, Pierre could not account for to himself, nor did he try to clarify to himself for whom and for what he found it so particularly delightful to sacrifice everything. He was not concerned with what he wanted to sacrifice it for, but the sacrificing itself constituted a new joyful feeling for him.
Man, I just see Tolstoy being complicated again, because two readings immediately come to mind. The first is the one that you've already spoken to, which is that the reason for him setting out for the army is to make himself useful. It's ultimately for himself. It's to prop up his own sense of worth. And if he could just sacrifice himself for something, then he would be useful and important. But on the other hand, he's just experienced this powerful moment with Natasha, in which he basically, and again, in the parlor with Julie, he sacrifices his reputation to someone else to protect Natasha. And that feeling of sacrifice, I think, is what gives him such joy on the night of the comet. And so it's like he is on to the real meaning of life here.
The real source of happiness, true happiness that everyone's thinking of.
But he doesn't know what to sacrifice for yet. And so he's just desperately looking. The answer is sacrifice. I have to sacrifice myself. And, you know, check, Pierre, that does sound like a good thing to do. But it is really important what it's for. And I was thinking, when you were talking about the way that he treats the servant, that he has a way of rushing into events to prove himself in this way. And they're the most dangerous, most life-altering things. When he's not being clear with himself and just rushing forward, that's what got him into a really bad marriage. And now he's going off to war where he could die.
Well, and in between there, his joining of that order, right? What are they called?
The Masons.
Freemasons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the most life-altering things that he's done in a big rush without considering.
Yeah. And so he's on to something, but he sure does put himself in a lot of danger along the way, trying to answer that question, what to sacrifice for. Death is on the line. That's what sacrifice is, right? A death of yourself, and that's either metaphorical or physical. In this case, it's physical.
It would be physical.
He could actually die. And so what is he dying for? Is it for Russia? Because he just watched Russians beating a Frenchman and didn't feel good about it. Mm-hmm. So is he on the Russian side even? Like, what would he be sacrificing himself for?
I don't know. I feel like even though this is an unfinished Pierre that we're seeing, he's very, very much in process and he's asking good questions but has no answers. I think it's still to his credit that he's asking the right questions. It still makes us love him that his heart is to sacrifice himself as quickly as possible and wherever it's needed. I think we, as much as we're taking him apart in this chapter and noticing the flaws and obvious faults and lacks that he has, he's still quality, you know? His instincts are so generous. And I loved him even as I mocked him at the end of this chapter.
You know that I'm so on board with you, but the thought comes to my head again, you know, the result of a sacrifice is that you'd be ending it all. It would be the same as catastrophe. And so there could be a sense of sacrifice in which he is, again, avoiding the responsibility of his current circumstances.
Oh, you're so right. Dang it.
So he's just such a mixed bag.
Well, and maybe that's in the middle of that passage there. With what Pierre could not account for to himself, nor did he try to clarify it to himself. He doesn't want to think about what should he be sacrificing it for? Because there might be a moment in which sacrifice is not the appropriate response, and he doesn't want to think about that.
But, like, to be fair to the guy, I don't know what, I don't have an answer for him.
No.
Like, don't sacrifice yourself for Helene. She's the worst. And, like, don't go back to the Freemasons. Those people were bad. And, like, you're not doing a super great job educating your peasants. And it might be that the peasants can take care of themselves. So it's not there. I don't know, Pierre. I don't know. And all, you're right. You shouldn't go chase Natasha because you are married. That's wrong.
Right.
Do you have an answer for him? I don't.
No, I certainly don't. I think it's another instance of Tolstoy just using art to paint life rather than to interpret it. Right. He says all the characters are kind of gray. They're gray areas because their motivations are so mixed. And
they're just so, so real.
Isn't Pierre so lifelike? Ha ha, I win. That's what I hear Tolstoy saying, right? You don't know his motivations because you don't know your own. Gotcha.
Well, Tolstoy now interrupts our regularly scheduled programming
to tell us
how everyone is wrong about Borodino.
Oh, man. Yeah, so he really does.
Let's try to, I'll just do my best here to give a quick précis of what happens in chapter 19. Please do. Please catch me if I'm wrong in this. As far as I understand it, what Tolstoy sees is that, given the handy map that he's provided for us on page 757, the way that historians have painted the setup of Borodino is to make it look like the Russians did this on purpose. That their army, the portion of their army that they had set up at Shevardino was an outpost, which would be a group of soldiers sent to watch for the approaching enemy. And the rest of the army had backed up to Borodino because it would be a great place for a last stand as the French march to Moscow.
That they chose this land because it was the best, that they did this on purpose.
And Tolstoy says, I have news for you. He actually, we're told in the footnotes, he spent a couple days in the area scouting for himself. So he's done boots on the ground research, looking at this land. And he's looked into the history and he says, well, there were 6,000 troops at Shevardino. That's way too many for an outpost. What an outpost is having just a couple guys there who can run back to the main army to let them know that the enemy is coming. The fact that we had so many troops, Shevardino tells us that the Russians intended that to be the left flank of a line that we can see, the historians thinking that they had, which actually I think it's a supposed French position, which is incorrect. The Russian position was true. They really did intend to have Shevardino as their left flank, and they extended it through the Nouveau, and because they were incorrect about the French position. So when the French fight them at Shevardino, there's like a panicked retreat to Borodino, which has no advantages for them. And the French are actually on the left, and everyone is forced to quickly as possible, move to the left. And because they're moving, their troops are even weaker because no one is there. Everyone's still trying to move into position while the fight's happening than they would have otherwise been. So this was not a planned stand on the part of the Russians,
but rather just an action reaction kind of playing out like the swarm life that he's talking about.
Yeah. So ultimately, I do think that is the end goal. You're right. That he's just showing us. He's actually done some historical factual research to show us that historians have interpreted the battle to make the Russians look good and to make it look like the retreat to Moscow was intentional, when in actuality, none of this was planned. It wasn't advantageous for either Napoleon or Kutuzov, and this was an accident. And look, I was right. This is how history goes.
Yeah, and more than that, this is how history goes, and we reinterpret history when we look back in order to conceal the mistakes of our commanders, but that just diminishes the glory of Russia and her people, he says. If we acknowledge this swarm life, Russia comes off looking even better, don't you see?
Because they're so in tune with that instinctive life.
Right, exactly.
And you alluded to this at the beginning of our discussion, but kind of what's going on here is that he himself is reinterpreting the historical facts to mm-hmm. support his own philosophy. And even though that philosophy is there is no philosophy,
he can't help himself.
He can't. Well, there's literally no other option.
Yeah.
Like he can't. He has no other way to prove his point, actually. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah. On the one hand, I understand. And there's nothing else that he could do. But then the irony underlying that is he's done exactly the same thing as the historians he's criticizing.
I can't get over the sarcastic tone as he's talking about the men heading up each of these sides, too. He says, and yet, in spite of all of the evidence that says Borodino was a terrible choice for this battle, the intelligent and experienced Kutuzov accepted battle. And Napoleon, a commander of genius, as they call him, offered battle, losing a quarter of his army and extending his line still more. So this was a terrible choice for both of them. And yet because of my thesis, Tolstoy says, because of the swarm life and the fact that it really wasn't in their control, despite the line on them and the labels that we've given them, looking, you know, here in the future, back at the past, they were just reacting. They couldn't help the way that things came about. And it was detrimental to them both. They didn't choose this. Great man theory exploded again.
Yeah, he's not subtle with that point.
He is not subtle. Nope.
He's going to make sure that we get it, including drawing us this nifty little map, which I have to say, it was pretty helpful. It was especially helpful in the next chapter as we watch Pierre approach the line of battle. And Tolstoy's like, he's at Taranovo. And I was like, oh, look, I wonder if that's on the map. And it was. And then he's like, he's on his way to Gorky. And I was like, hey, look, that's on the map too. Oh, now he's on the line of battle.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then he talks to the doctor and the doctor's like, it's just over that hill there. You'll be able to see it with your eyeballs. I'm like, Pierre, don't go. What an idiot.
Well, he's going there now. He's there. On the way there, though, he has this moment in which he's coming down the hill from which he met the doctor, and he sees approaching him a line of wounded soldiers returning from this skirmish that happened at the town that I'm going to check the map to, Shevardino. And they're on their way back, and they're wounded. And behind him is a cavalry, and they're crossing paths, and he sees that the cavalry aren't even thinking about the wounded, even though it's so obvious that that's the fate that they're headed toward. And he looks at this cart that has stopped by him, And it says, Pierre was so deep in thought, he didn't hear a question that the soldier asked him. He looked first at the cavalry regiment that had now run into the train of the wounded, then at the cart he was standing near and on which two wounded men were sitting and one was lying. And it seemed to him that there, in them, lay the solution to the problem that preoccupied him. One of the soldiers sitting on the cart had probably been wounded in the cheek. His whole head was bound in rags, and one cheek was swollen as big as a baby's head. Gross.
That's
his
disgusting.
Mouth and nose were askew. Why that comparison? Oh, that's disgusting.
Oh, so gross.
The soldier was looking at the cathedral, at the cathedral, and crossing himself. The second, a young boy, a recruit, fair-haired and as white as though there were no blood at all in his delicate face, looked at Pierre with a fixed, kindly smile. The third lay prone, and his face could not be seen. The cavalry singers were just passing by the cart, and they sing. They poured out a soldier's dance song, as if seconding them, but with another sort of merriment, the metallic ring of the bells throbbed on high.
The next two sentences kind of complete the thought, and with yet another sort of merriment, the sun's hot rays bathed the top of the slope opposite. But under the slope, by the cart with the wounded men, near the panting little horse where Pierre was standing, it was damp, bleak, and sad. So there's this overwhelming contrast of life and sunlight and merriment passing death and consequence. And there's like never the twain shall meet. There's no acknowledgement in the living of what's coming.
Well, that's a problem. But Pierre says, looking at this whole scene, he found the answer to his problem.
Yeah, I have no idea what that means.
Well, shoot, because I was going to ask you.
Oh, dang it. Well, I'll guess, but do you have a guess?
I can probably come up with one, but you go first.
Well, no, because you just brought this to my attention, and now I'm wrestling with it in my mind. Here we are, like, live time, everyone, trying to figure out what in the world Tolstoy is saying. As far as I got was acknowledging, I guess, a problem rather than an answer, right? You've got these soldiers are so unaware of what's coming. Either that or they're doing exactly what the people in the salons are doing. When you're on your own, it's a fight or flight mentality. When you're in a group, you make merry until you can't avoid it anymore. And here they are in a big cavalry group, not acknowledging what's coming for them tomorrow. They can't help it. So why dwell?
Well, that's true of the cavalry, but the first thing he sees are the wounded men, the one who has a cheek swollen to the size of a baby's head. And that guy is looking at the cathedral and crossing himself, and the other boy he can see, who looks like all the blood is drained out of him, is smiling at Pierre with a kind smile. Those are two very gentle actions on the part of men who have just suffered horrible violence. One has turned to the cathedral and is giving reverence to God. And the other one is smiling kindly at him. And so it just makes me wonder if the fate that everyone fears, maybe this is telling us, is it really all that bad? These men who've just experienced it that themselves still have this humanity about them.
Or maybe even more so. I mean, if the kindly eye contact with that guy, it seems to me that your reading is the result of the sacrifice that these men have already given is either an acknowledgement of God, a higher power, some kind of hope as he crosses himself, or relationship with fellow men, right? More compassion for your fellow man. He looks at him kindly, makes a connection with Pierre on the way by. Or that third example, he's just dead. he's dead in the cart. You know, like, it's basically, maybe it's the answer that Pierre is hoping for. In all of my sacrificing, here's what comes as a result.
Well, and it could be that, therefore, the merrymaking of the Calvary and the ringing of the church bells are not out of place, and that they are actually the ones who are right in not thinking ahead to what awaits them at the battlefront, because they can't possibly know, and it looks like suffering actually has gentled the condition of these soldiers who have suffered it.
Whoa.
I don't know. Suffering is usually not a bad thing in Russian novels, so we're just taking a stab at it here.
Yeah. Well, that's deeper than I got on my own. I appreciate you.
Well, I don't know. Well, it also feels completely useless because there's no way that this is actually the solution to Pierre's problems. He says he's seen this and it has solved the problem, but I don't think that this is the climax, given that there's still 500 pages left in the novel.
Well, and that the chapter doesn't end there. He says this is a solution, but the chapter actually ends with his musing on what the doctor has said about casualties for the morning. He said it's a strange notion that among those thousands of men alive, healthy, young, and old, who had stared with Mary's surprise at his hat, there were probably 20,000 destined for wounds and death, maybe the same ones he had seen. And it struck Pierre.
Even that idyllic scene that he's just witnessed, even if there is some truth in it, when the cavalry passed by, the guy who was crossing himself, he gets angry at the singers. Some songbirds, he said reproachfully. So it's just like, bang, the reality of the moment drops back in and the solution is gone.
Yeah. And Pierre joins him and says, how can you wink at the wounded headed where you are, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. We got a long way to go in this novel, so I'm glad to see Pierre still in process. Me too.
What do we? There's one last thing in this chapter before our reading ends, and that is the participation of the musics in the battle strikes Pierre. Yeah. It says, the sight of these bearded musics working on the battlefield with their strange clumsy boots, with their sweaty necks, and some with their side-button shirts open, revealing their sunburned collarbones, impressed Pierre more strongly than anything he had seen or heard so far about the solemnity and significance of the present moment. And there was, I forget who he heard it from, the guy who tells him, do you remember who it is?
It's the soldier who crossed himself and then was angry with the cavalrymen singing and says, oh, so some songbirds. Today it wasn't just soldiers, I saw peasants too. They even drive peasants to it. There's no sorting them out nowadays. They want the whole people to throw their weight into it. They want to make an end of it.
The whole people throw their weight into it.
Mm-hmm. And there's an unspoken, unnamed they in charge from the soldier's perspective, orchestrating events. So he believes in the great man theory, right? There are people who are in charge of us, and our wills are not our own. And look how they drive even the peasants.
But is that ultimately supposed to be a beautiful image of the people of Russia rising up to protect their own land? Maybe even that is the answer, that organized military has a bunch of flaws in it because people are going to be jockeying for power. But when the own people rise up to defend their own land, then there's something more natural and good about that.
Oh, I do like that better. Well, because Pierre listens. It says, Pierre listened and understood everything despite the vagueness of the soldier's words and nodded approvingly. Hmm. So he seems to think it's good that all the peasants are throwing themselves into it. There's something healthy and whole and happy in this work.
We can't idealize them too much because it wasn't all that long ago that we saw a bunch of them rising up against Maria.
Yep, that's all I can think of when I think of the weird word music.
Tolstoy tends to not let ideals hang out too long, unchallenged. We made it. We made it without
you. I know. I think it's so funny because the conclusions of our conversations and the transitions are always Ian's, and you've done an excellent job of helping me out, but I have no idea what to do in conclusions.
Nope, I know. So exactly now we're like,
do, ba, ba, do, you know?
There's that moment where we both said what we wanted to say and then silence.
And this is where usually seamlessly draws it all together and we don't know what we're doing. So listeners, please tell Ian the next time you see him that we missed him today.
Word.
Oh, this has been fun, Emily.
This was fun anyway. So thank you for joining me today.
Oh my goodness.
And thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in. We promise that Ewan will be back to join us next time. And that'll be for the next 5 chapters. We continue on our march through Russia under attack.
Again. Get ready to live or die.
Well, we'll see you next time and bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
Want to follow along with our reading? You can find a link to the schedule in the show notes for this episode. How to Eat an Elephant is a part of the Center for Lit podcast network. Visit our website at www.centerforlit.com to find our other literary shows, resources, and our membership program, the Pelican Society, where you can get access to a variety of live discussion groups. You can also find us on most social media channels. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, happy reading!